Ciao, and welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast, a dialogue about how space technology and exploration are transforming our solar system.
Noah, we're delighted to have you here today on the Frontier Space Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How are things in Edinburgh?
They're absolutely fine, yeah. Typical Scottish weather today, so a bit of sunshine, a bit of rain.
Bonjour and welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast, Alex.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've joined a special episode here and really take a deep breath as we wander on this kind of this mental journey out in the deep space and to the farthest we've gone beyond Earth in an episode and out to the solar gravitational lens. It's about 550 astronomical units out.
That's a bare minimum. Not the easiest place to get to, I might say.
It sounds like we're converging and we're getting closer to SGL.
Well, so I think the idea
has been advancing. The progress on getting there is still an open question. You might have heard the recent news about NASA starting to power down the Voyager spacecraft, which has been running for something like 4 decades.
It's on its way out of the
solar system at a pretty remarkable speed using a double flyby of Jupiter and Saturn. And it's made it to something like, I think, 150 AU in this 40 years it's been traveling, which is only about a quarter of the way that you would need to go to get to the SGL.
Yeah, it was, from your study, you mentioned the Jupiter flyby increased the delta V by like 6 kilometers a second, 4 kilometers a second.
It sounds about right. I think it depends a little
bit on exactly the timing that you get, but you can definitely use the planets to steal some energy and send your craft going out a little bit faster.
If you're super
serious about doing these gravitational flybys, you might even consider a trajectory which first goes to Jupiter, uses Jupiter to slow down, believe it or not. And like once you've slowed down sufficiently, you can fall towards the sun. And then when you're falling towards the sun, you can do a slingshot maneuver around the sun first and steal a lot of energy from the sun to sort of fling yourself out really fast. And that kind of a double slingshot trajectory might even help you get to the SGL even faster.
Something like, do you think we could push 20 kilometers a second?
I think, what is Voyager speed?
Isn't it like 40?
I'm not sure. It could be.
Yeah. I have to double check that exact number, but I think it's like
40K or something miles per hour.
Maybe there's a factor of two that I'm off.
Yeah, the units are important.
I think when people are typically discussing these solar sail missions, they're using units of AU per year, which is not exactly, you know, easily translatable to human experience.
Yeah. Could you enlighten us what the solar gravitational lens is and how we can use this as a giant telescope?
All right, let's start at the beginning. Yeah, so what's the deal with this whole thing, right?
So yeah. Astronomy, right? Like you want to use telescopes, you want to look at stuff in outer space. And so most of the telescopes we build, you know, you can put them in your backyard or you can put them on the top of a mountain. And some of the very best telescopes you launch on a rocket to low Earth orbit, like Hubble, or to L2, like James Webb, right? It's like the solar gravitational lens is sort of like a radically different kind of telescope, because instead of having your primary mirror or lens be a part of the instrument that you deploy. Instead, your primary lens is sort of found in nature. The solar gravitational lens is just that. The sun has gravity and gravity bends light, and that bending is just like what a lens does, except it's actually not a very good lens. It's actually a kind of crappy lens. It's just that it's so big and so massive that the magnification is so large that it has some unusual properties that you can exploit, that an ordinary lens that you might be able to build, or an ordinary mirror that you could, you know, put in a telescope would never really have, because they're just far too small.
So the concept to use the sun
as a gravitational lens has been around for nearly 50 years. It was originally conceived by a Stanford professor named Von Eshleman. He wanted to use the SGL to communicate in between like interstellar space. So he was thinking, you put a radio beacon at this special location at 600 AU away from the direction you want to transmit in. Basically, you have to send a spacecraft to the location diametrically opposed to the communication direction. And so using the sun's gravity, you can amplify your radio signal. So if you wanted to like send Wi-Fi to Alpha Centauri or something, you might put a beacon at a specific location that's in line with the sun and Alpha Centauri at this special distance where the focusing starts to work. And then you could have a really small amount of power being transmitted from a really ordinary size spacecraft, magnified by this enormous lens, which is the sun's gravity, and use that to amplify your signal. And that was 50 years ago. And, you know, this idea has definitely been around since, you know, a long time, but it was recently reinvigorated now that we know more about extrasolar planets. There is a researcher at JPL named Slava Turyashev who came up with this concept to use the gravitational lens of the sun to image planets. Now we can do things with this lens that you could never do with a normal telescope, like see the details on their surface, which is really just quite remarkable. And, you know, something that I think people like space enthusiasts and, you know, general astronomy lay people would love to see, right? I mean, have never seen what an exoplanet actually looks like in that sort of detail. We can only see exoplanets through indirect means or through direct means in very, you know, quite like ways. You can see just a little speck at most, but nothing with a lot of detail.
And we're wondering, I think we're reading about how there's this scattering of electromagnetic waves, and like as these photons, as they're bending, do these, you know, exoplanet past photons, do they mostly follow the electromagnetic fields or the gravity field lines?
So it's an interesting question.
So are you asking like does the light from the planet get scattered by like the sun's gravity, or also by like the sun's plasma, which is it's a big incandescent ball of gas, right?
Yeah, in the electromagnetic fields. Curious.
So there's both of those things matter, and they sort of matter depending on what wavelength of light you're looking at. So if you're trying to use a radio beacon, it turns out that the sun's corona, which is a highly turbulent magnetic plasma, can really, really distort, you know, your coherent radio signal. But if you want to use like visible light, like optical wavelengths, then the scattering from the plasma is not as important, and it's mostly just controlled by the gravity of the sun.
And so it might actually be
easier to use this sun as a telescope to look for planets than it would be to, you know, use the sun as like a radio amplifier to send radio signals, because the turbulence in the corona will distort the coherent radio waves in your transmitter.
That's awesome. I was reading about how about your impressive study here on entitled the integral field spectroscopy with SGL. Really cool. It seemed to it was impressive, but also hard to follow with a lot of the mathematics. Could you enlighten us kind of what were your takeaways and yes.
Sure. So yeah, I'd be happy to explain the contents of the paper I wrote. Actually got quite a lot of attention, I think, from the media, which I was kind of surprised about, because
this is part of my PhD thesis. And so,
you know, I'm still a student technically, and
this paper, I think, I had a lot of fun with, because it's exploring, you know, this wild concept, and
it's really sort of fleshing out the theory behind it all. But getting into a practical implementation starts to become, you know, a difficult engineering task. And so one of the goals I had with this paper was to sort of illuminate where we have current technology that is sufficient to make this happen, and where the technology falls short, and what sort of things we need to work on in order to make this sort of thing possible in the future. So those were my large overarching goals. And the paper was sort of segmented into three major sections about different kinds of questions. The first kinds of questions are about the orbits. So because you need to get to this really special location in space, you have to consider how you would send a spacecraft to that location. So you need to get really far away. And so to do that, you either need to be extremely patient and wait a really long time, or you need to build this craft that can travel really quickly. And that's one of these basic sort of engineering trade-offs, right? Are you willing to wait 100 years? Because if you are, then you can use the rockets that they've already used. But if you want to wait 20 years, then you're going to have to come up with some new invention. And so that was one of the conclusions in the first section. We need to make better propulsion technologies. I talked a little bit about solar sails and how you might use a solar sail. I don't think I've ever actually heard of somebody flying a solar sail except for maybe just a basic test, but nobody's actually used a solar sail to get anywhere significant. And so that would be a sort of novel thing that would need to be worked on and developed to make this concept more realistic. The next sort of section is all about the optics. There's an optical problem associated with building a telescope with this kind of crappy lens that nature has just sort of placed in your backyard. I like to think, you know, we have this giant, massive ball of gas, which we can use like a gravitational lens, but it's not a good lens. If you build a lens, you make a very particular shape. It's got a parabolic optical path difference. And this is so when a plane wave, just a beam of light that's coherent, comes in, it creates a focus. And with that focus, you can use it to make an image extremely easily, like the cell phone camera that you have, like the webcam. They have a parabolic lens in them, and then they focus the light onto a CCD, and those CCDs, you know, detect the photons and record the intensity of the light, and that's how we make an image. But the gravitational lens of the sun has a really messed up point spread function, we call it. It's the impulse response of the optical linear operator of the lens. And so you can think of the point spread function as just what a point of light looks like when viewed through the lens. And so if you have myopia like me and you take your glasses off and you look at a little LED, it's going to be a little smudgy blob, and it's going to have a particular shape. And that particular shape is going to be associated with the distortions in the lens in your eyeballs. So the gravitational lens of the sun has a very special shape for its point spread function. It turns out to be an asteroid, which is a four-pointed curve. It's in a family of curves called hypocycloids. They're basically circles rolling around inside other circles. And so if you imagine you have an outer circle and you have a smaller inner circle, and then you put a point on that inner circle and you roll the circle around inside the outer circle, the curve that rolling inner circle traces out is the hypocycloid. And so when the ratio of those circles is a factor of 4, you get a 4-pointed star. It's called the asteroid. And so it's this sort of shape. And so when you look at just a point of light with the solar gravitational lens, it spreads out into this 4-pointed star. And that was one of the sort of interesting conclusions that came out of this optical study. It turns out that has a major implication for how to use the lens of the sun, because this distortion can be a great hindrance or a great benefit depending on certain things. And this certain thing that I'm referencing is the location of the planet on the sky. So the sun is not perfectly spherically symmetric. It's slightly wider around the equator than the poles. And this is because it's spinning and it's in hydrostatic equilibrium. So the gravitational force pulling the matter in balances with the radiative pressure pushing out. But the spinning creates a sort of centripetal force, which distorts the equator. So we have a little bit of oblateness in the gravitational potential. It's a little wide. And so if you're looking down the pole of the sun, this doesn't matter at all. But if you're looking along the equator of the sun, this effect becomes dominant. And so which planet you want to observe, depending on where it is on the sky, is going to line up with the equator or the pole of the sun just by chance. Like it's going to be somewhere. And so you're going to create this alignment with the lens, it's going to have some particular angle that depends on where the planet is on the sky relative to the direction that the axis of the sun points. And so nobody had really ever pointed this out before, but if you wanted to say, look at Alpha Centauri, or you wanted to look at Beta Pictoris, they're gonna have sort of a different value for this relative angle, and that will greatly influence the resulting image that's formed at the SGL. Hope that's clear. I just sort of talked for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, I think we followed most. And congratulations there. So such a SGL telescope could potentially access both of those points near the pole and equator, or orbit to both, or is it?
Unfortunately not. It's just going to take way too long. So any mission like this is really constrained to probably look at exactly one solar system. So if you wanted to look at multiple different star systems, you probably need multiple different craft that each individually visit the two different locations, right? Because these locations are 600 AU away from the sun, and they're also in line with the sort of direction to the star or planet you want to look at. And so to get from one of those spots to the other at the SGL, you could conceivably have an orbit that connects them, right? Because you get out there and then you get to some circular orbit. But the circular orbits at these distances have orbital timescales of like 10,000 years. So unfortunately, I don't think such a thing will be possible within the span of any sense of human patience. But if you wanted to send one craft to each system, they could each sort of, one craft could go to each system. So you'd have to build multiple spacecraft. But yeah, that's one of the major bummers, I would say, is you only really get one shot. But if you have a really interesting planet that you really want to observe in great detail, which you might find, there's plans to build better space telescopes in near Earth orbit. Like, I don't know if you've heard of LUVOIR, but this was recently recommended by the Decadal Survey, the Astro 2020 Decadal Survey. they suggested you build this like 6-meter optical UV telescope to like hunt for Earth-sized planets. And you wouldn't be able to resolve them, but you could see them and like spectrally examine the colors of their atmosphere. And so they are suggesting that this is something like $15 billion mission that might launch in the 2040s could find something like 20, 30 maybe Earth-sized planets and characterize their atmospheres. And well, if that's successful and you find a few planets that are like really interesting and maybe they look like there's photosynthesis or something, you know, in their atmospheres or something, like, you don't know, like maybe you find a really, really interesting planet with Louvoir and you want to follow it up and do extremely detailed observations. So then maybe you would consider sending a craft to the SGL and doing a detailed follow-up of a high priority, important target.
Another thought that comes to mind is that what the depth and however many hundreds of thousands of kilometers of atomic oxygen you have and how that could potentially be a function of exoplanet habitability. It's interesting.
Are you talking about the planets themselves?
Yeah, like up in the thermosphere and exosphere, you know, like there's 500 kilometers of 500 to 1,000 kilometers of atomic oxygen, and just, you know, how thick that, how much oxygen above and what that means toward photosynthesis and great oxidation.
Yeah, if you find something like oxygen in a planet's atmosphere, it's kind of unusual, I think. Oxygen is really reactive. It wants to attach to other things, basically, because it's extremely electronegative. But free oxygen, yeah. On Earth, it's a biosignature gas because of the cyanobacteria in the ocean. So if you find large quantities of oxygen combined with other things that it should attached to, like methane, that's maybe what you might call a smoking gun for life, although people will of course still question it. So
this is exciting stuff. And in your study here, you also you outlined about how to maintain the alignment with the target planet, and the optical effects and the sources of noise. And then I was reading about this special algorithm that you designed with the team to undistort the light.
Okay.
Would love to hear more on your accomplishments there. Yes.
Okay, so you want to hear about the alignment problem or the distortion of the light?
Maybe distortion of the light. It sounds very interesting.
Okay, so it turns out this special algorithm is really extremely boring. It's just, there's really nothing too crazy about it. It turns out that this algorithm, which is just a, you know, regularized inverse called a pseudo inverse, it's a linear inverse of a, let's just say, degenerate map. It's a degenerate map. There's a linear transformation of the image, which creates the Einstein ring. And this, I wish I could share my screen with you on my laptop because I'd have some pictures that would help explain this, but let me see if I can have my laptop join the Zoom call because this mapping is kind of difficult to explain just with words. But basically, if you think there's an image of the planet and the image gets compressed into a ring, this is the Einstein ring. It's going to make me leave on my phone, so I'm worried that I won't be able to talk to you when my computer joins. So and maybe I'll just do the extremely basic.
Okay, I think we're following here. And so this exoplanet image is in this like kind of toroidal ring called the Einstein ring.
Okay, here's me, my computer screen. I don't know if you can actually see this diagram.
Yes, yes.
In this diagram, there's a circle in the middle, and there's a blue slice, and there's a yellow slice. I like to think of these pairs of pizza slices
of the planet that
get mapped into these segments, basically, around the edge of the ring. And so this
picture, I think, is extremely helpful for me to imagine what happens to the light of the planet when you're looking at the Einstein ring. So
you just think about these little pizza slices that you have, and then those points in those pizza slices get compressed into two points on the opposite side of the ring.
And so the trick is that if you examine the structure of the brightness of the ring as you look around, you can sort of make out the details on the planet's surface, but
a lot of the information is lost because of this compression. And so the trick to recover it is to try and invert this compression.
And so to do this, you need to have a lot of signal to noise, basically, because it's a lossy channel. So you lose details. But the advantage of the solar gravitational lens is that you gain a large number of photons. And so we talk about the magnification of the lens as basically the ratio of the area of the image on the sky to the area of the image of the object. And so the planet is extremely small. It's super far away. But the ring has an apparent size on the sky that's very large. It's just stretched in very thin, and it's around the edge of the sun. And so you get a much larger image of the planet when you're looking at the ring. And so the total number of photons you collect is like 9 orders of magnitude larger than if you had just pointed your telescope at the planet. And so this factor of a billion in magnification sort of offsets the compression of the image. And so you can sort of do some incredible things, but this mapping is degenerate. And so you need a trick to break this degeneracy. And so the existing concepts, the one that Slava Turyashev suggested, and this is sort of still the baseline concept, is that to break this degeneracy, you send your spacecraft around in slightly offset ways. So
you can think like the
sun is like a projector lens, and it forms an image like if you hung up a bed sheet, there would be an image of the planet. And so that image, that projection, has a size, and that projection is about 1 kilometer in diameter. So it's quite large. You can never really build a 1-kilometer-sized CCD to put there. And so you have like a meter scale telescope, and you have that meter scale telescope sort of fan across the image, and sort of at each spot, it sort of collects a little bit of light like a single pixel would, and you sort of step through all the pixels. And so that's one strategy you can use to break this degeneracy. But we demonstrated in this paper that if you do that and you combine it with the structure of the ring, which you can use to gain additional knowledge, that you can do a better job of reconstructing these images. And in one extreme edge case where you're looking directly along the equator of the sun and your planet is far enough away, you can skip this whole scanning bit. It turns out that when the distortions of the lens are at their biggest, this is when the quadrupole moment of the gravitational potential is causing the most distortions of the point spread function, that your blur, this asteroid-shaped blur of a point, becomes as large as the image is. So you have a 1-kilometer-scale image, and you have roughly a 1-kilometer-scale blur of that image. And so the light is all mixed up. But because the blur is as big as the image is, you can park the telescope at one spot and collect light from every location on the planet. And with the knowledge of how the light gets bent into this ring, and that you can collect all the light from every location in the planet at one spot, you can just look at the structure in the ring and then invert the degenerate mapping to get a complete image of the planet.
And this is extremely difficult and requires a very large amount of signal to noise,
especially if you want a high resolution image, which is probably not feasible. But if you wanted to do a low resolution image, like a little postage stamp, and like, I'm thinking like maybe 10 by 10 pixels, which is like a pretty nice postage stamp, I'd say, you know, extremely tiny image of a planet's surface, but you could conceivably do that without the scanning trick. But
in the practicality,
I think the scanning trick is extremely practical solution, especially if you don't have this perfect alignment. And if the planet isn't far enough away, it doesn't always work. So that was one of the little interesting things, I think, that we sort of discovered by playing around with this model. But
yeah, I don't know if that's a clear explanation
or if there's something else I'm missing and could help you explain further. But
yeah, I think we have a much clearer picture of this concept now. Yes. And so forget, but you mentioned this, the spacecraft could be in this scanning window for a certain amount of time, and then collect like 5K by 5K or 10K by 10K image resolution lizard of the planet?
I don't think that would really be feasible. That's far too high resolution.
Yeah, I think the concept that Dr. Turyashev mentions, aiming at 1K by 1K,
so he wants to go for a megapixel, which is a, you know, still quite large number of pixels, a million pixels.
The thing that's
5K by 5K, I think, is the original resolution of the data set we used to test these models. So I used some pretty high resolution images of Earth, which were taken with a geostationary weather satellite. And these data sets are some of my favorite because they're just absolutely spectacular. You know, you can watch the weather of the Earth and like 5K by 5K resolution. You can see all the details in the clouds. Yeah, the meteorological data sets are really quite pretty, but we used those sort of as a very, you know, aesthetic demonstration of the concept, because we have these super high resolution, you know, images of Earth, and then we can, you know, model the gravitational lens of the sun on those images and see how the ring is formed, and then we can test the inversion
and see that it actually is possible to do this inversion.
When you have high enough signal to noise, it feels like anything is really possible.
The major constraints are, could you develop an instrument that would not only reasonably get to the focal distance in time, but acquire the signal to noise you need to do the reconstruction rapidly enough? Because, you know, the planet isn't still life. You know, the planet is changing. It's spinning. The clouds are moving. You know, there's things happening on the planet. It's going around its star, and so it's going from a crescent to quarter to gibbous, you know, like the moon does. And so the illumination that you're looking at is time variable. And so you really need to be able to make enough observations rapidly enough that you can do this reconstruction and get an image and not like a smeared out mess of, you know, a planet that has spun around and you can't see anything. It's like got a motion blur. That's the challenge.
Nice. It sounds like there are so many potential exciting applications in addition to imaging exoplanets too. I was reading about how we can kind of like image and quantify all sorts of astronomical events, you know, black holes, quasars. It could really significantly help us understand this multiverse we're in here.
Yes. Yeah, you could conceivably come up with a similar concept to look at anything, right? It's just a lens. Like, you could build a telescope to look at anything you want. Now, would it be worth it is the question. Is it going to be cheaper or better
to build such a like telescope to look at something. There's a different question from like
the science that you want to do, for example. So I think that the major advantages that the SGL has are this extremely high angular resolution, so that you would never be able to, you know, see these sort of details on the planet because the planets are so tiny and so far away. Build an ordinary telescope that would let you see those level of details, the telescope would have to be basically the size of the sun. That's just simply not feasible. You can't build something that large. It's like a Dyson sphere. It's just like a megastructure. It's enormous, right? There's no humanly feasible way to build something that large, at least as that I can imagine. But you know, you could build a really ordinary sized telescope and send it to this really special location, and use the sun as the lens, and see these things in extremely high resolution. It's pretty interesting to think, because it might be possible. But to suggest that it would revolutionize every field would, well, that would take a huge amount of investment, I think. It's not clear to me that if you want to observe, say, galaxies, that it's going to be better, because the galaxies are kind of large, aren't they? They're definitely much larger than the planets in terms of their angular size on the sky. And so, you know,
maybe the galaxy people don't really benefit a lot. Maybe for really distant objects.
I don't know.
I would have to think about that more carefully.
Yeah, it sounds like everything converges toward these smaller scale demos. And you mentioned the 1 meter scale telescope, and but you, I don't know, you know, you start thinking about, well, what could we collect with a 5 meter or 10 meter telescope?
Yeah, if you want to go more and more ambitiously, you know, you can always increase the functionality. It's just at a certain point, it becomes a question of feasibility rather than, you know, just the theory.
Yeah, so the one I was reading about from a NASA NIAC study, they mentioned there's a lot of interference at the SGL beyond around 547.6 AU. But that would be a good place for such a telescope. After achieving a high velocity of 150 kilometers a second, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, if you want to get there, if you want to get there in any sort of reasonable amount of time, then
yeah, you're going to need to go pretty quick. I'm trying to look. So
the nominal mission design I had written down in the paper had a velocity at periastron, which is basically a departure velocity of 47 kilometers per second,
which is, I think,
equivalent to the New Horizons spacecraft, the one that went to visit Pluto. You've probably heard. New Horizons got to Pluto, which was at like 30 AU in about a decade. So
3 AU per year-ish. And it was going, you know, 57 kilometers per second relative to the sun. That, if you just used that rocket again, basically, you would have to wait like 100 years to get to the SGL, which was quite a long time. And, I don't think
people would want to wait that long. Personally, I don't think I would mind being that patient, because I would no longer be here, so it's not my issue to worry about. But I think, for example, like, if you wanted Congress to fund something like this, you might want to suggest that it would return in a matter of decades, not in a matter of centuries. And so,
yeah, you need to go a little bit faster than
what New Horizons did in order to do that. But
I think that's certainly possible. New Horizons was, it didn't even use the Saturn flyby like Voyager did. It just
did a Jupiter flyby. So if you had a special flyby trajectory, or if you had solar sails, I think you could bring the time down to a couple decades.
Yeah, I would imagine however many years from now, we're beam launching, you know, however hundreds of solar sails or laser sails out to the SGL. It'd be very exciting.
Yeah, there's people that want to use these laser-powered sails too, right? You have some kind of, it's like a sail craft, but plus a ground-based station for sending up laser power. They want to send little tiny spacecraft to Alpha Centauri at a quarter of the speed of light using these machines. But I don't know, they still feel very fanciful and futuristic to me. So I don't know what the progress on those is.
Sounds like they're making good progress, but not quite sure either. But I think it would make sense to envision the design of such a SGL telescope with these kind of solar sails, you know, so you kind of like combine the two designs and with these kind of small payloads that could be delivered piece by piece, mission by mission. Here's how that would come together.
It's certainly interesting to think about a modular design to this, right? So like if you could design an extremely small satellite that would be capable of going very fast, could you send a large number of them to sort of independently observe like the different pixels? And I think this is part of the design that Dr. Turishev looked at.
If you wanted to have these little CubeSats in an array,
a big array of little CubeSats. I think there's a challenge with that because you have to be able to separate the light from the planet and the light from the sun. So this is something we sort of really haven't talked about yet, but you're looking at the sun. The sun is really bright. You need to be able to know if the light you're looking at is the ring of the planet, which is being magnified. It's quite bright compared to the planet, but is it bright compared to the sun? The sun is way closer than the planet is and way bigger, and the sun is also way brighter than the planet is. So even though the light from the planet is magnified a billion times, you still have to compete with the sun. The sun is really bright.
And so you need to be able to separate those, and you need to be able to do that reliably. And so if you try and send an array of little CubeSats, they're going to have a much more difficult time separating the light from the sun and the planet. Whereas if you send like a Hubble-sized spacecraft, which is, you know, quite big, actually, it's a meter diameter, you know, bigger than me, for sure, it'll be better at reliably separating the signals because you need to be able to resolve the gap in between the edge of the ring and the edge of the solar disk. And then we need to deploy what we call a coronagraph, which is an instrument that was developed to observe the solar corona, to block the light from the sun. The photosphere has a disk, and you block the light from the sun's disk, and then you can observe the faint light from the corona, like how you would see in a solar eclipse. And it turns out that the corona is actually about the same brightness as the planet. And this is actually kind of remarkable because this is just by chance. It really couldn't be more fortuitous, but the corona and the planet are very similar in brightness. And so if you can sufficiently block the light from the disk, you only have to sort of lose the signal to noise from the light from the corona. And then you could conceivably manage that one, I think,
if you have a spectroscopic strategy where you separate the light out into its different colors, you could reasonably find a way to subtract the contamination from the corona and pull out the light in the planet's ring. Now, I think this is probably the sort of most ideal type of instrument, right? Because once you can separate the light from the sun's disk, the corona,
the planet's ring, if you can reliably extract
those different components, then you have a much better shot of, you know, pulling off these reconstructions.
Oh, it's very interesting to think about in here. We start thinking about the solar gravitational lens and how this applies to other stars and how this lens becomes a key kind of area of interest, but then also how it might potentially there might be a similar, you know, Earth gravitational lens.
Okay, there are other bodies, right? The different masses and different locations. Why can't we use, say, Jupiter as a lens or something, you know, like, why not? And so there's a very good reason you want to use the sun, and it's because it's the biggest. There are these gravitational lenses for all the other masses. There's a gravitational lens for the speck of dust on my eyeglasses right now. But those lenses have focal lengths that are extremely long. So the solar gravitational lens is sort of like focal length is like 600 AU, which is just absurdly far away, right? But the focal length for the Earth or for the Jupiter's gravitational lens is even further. So it's really something where you want to go big. And I would even go so far as to suggest that you want to go extremely big. So if you had a black hole, say, like, suppose that planet 9 is a black hole, right, in the outer solar system, that would be a way better gravitational lens than the sun would be. It would just be way better to have a black hole as your primary lens, because, well, there for a couple of reasons. So the black hole is massive, obviously, like the sun, but it's also smaller in angular scale, so it's way denser. Because it's denser, you can get closer to it and still have this focal length work. So yeah, you have to go really far away from the sun because you need to have the Einstein ring that forms
be larger than the disk of the sun. The sun has a finite size disk, and so the Einstein ring needs to be bigger than that.
You had a black hole, the disk of the black hole is
going to be extremely tiny, and so that you can get much closer to it, and so
it'll be easier to use it as a lens.
Yeah, I was reading about a black hole discovered not too far away, so I'm curious on the potential, like, how much better would a black hole gravitational lens be?
It'd be better, without a doubt.
How much better, I think, depends on, you know, what the black hole is, because it could be way worse. For example, if you have an extremely active black hole,
it's currently accreting material. You know, there's a big cloud of gas that's falling in and spiraling in.
Well, that would really get in your way, right?
But you'd want it to be quiescent, but not active. But I think it would, you know, if you had like an ideal black hole, like one that's not accreting, I think it would be way better. But I think most black holes are, you know, they've got fairly active regions around them that would get in the way. Like, I don't know if you've seen the EHT photographs of M87 or the recent results of Sagittarius A star. There's definitely stuff happening around the black hole. There's, you know, there's accretion disks
and there's plasma, and so that would all get in the way of using it as a lens. But
if that wasn't in the way, then I think they would be way better lenses.
See, Nick. We'll keep this in mind, yes. And I think it's over here. You know, if we were to flash forward, you know, hundreds of years to the year 2300 or something, you know, if these gigawatt lasers are blasting all sorts of spacecraft, and you know, we've detected this advanced species, how could your work and the SGL, how could this enable interstellar communication?
That's really going way beyond anything I've thought about.
I thought I was pushing it with 100 years. You want to go more than 100?
Yeah, time I don't know, whatever time scale, whether it's our grandfather, grandchildren, or kids, I don't know. But sooner the better, ideally, yes.
So I think for me, I was thinking like 2 decades roughly until Louvoir, right? And then so once you've got Louvoir, which would be like 2 decades, that's going to take another decade to return all of its answers. So like 2050-ish, we might have, say, 20 Earth-like planets that we know about in the immediate neighborhood. I'd say a couple decades from now, the solar sails will probably be developed enough to be sensible. And so you might consider a mission to the SGL on the order of 20 years to get there. And so by 2070, you could be visiting the SGL. Now, the thing is about the SGL, it just gets better and better as time goes on, because the 600 AU number is really the bare minimum. If you want to do the best case scenario at the SGL, you really want 2300 AU. And this is because as you go further and further away, the disk of the sun it shrinks in apparent size. It starts to get smaller as you get further away. But the Einstein ring gets smaller too. But it gets smaller slower, which is a little unusual because of the gravitational lens. And it gets smaller slower to the point where there's a certain distance where the angular size between the edge of the solar disk and the inside of the ring is at its largest. And this is really the optimal spot to be in if you want to image with the SGL. It's like 2300 AU. So if you get to the beginning of the focal plane at 600 AU in 2 decades, it's going to take you, six more decades to get to the optimal location. And so this is starting to push something like, 2130, which is 110 years from now at the earliest, right? I mean, this is if everything goes perfectly. And those distances, you really start to open up even more capability to lens. And so, designing a mission to last 8 decades in space is really something that goes beyond anything that's been demonstrated in the current, but is not out of the question of reality. It just becomes an immense engineering task that may be possible. No guarantees, obviously, but I don't think it's out of the question
within, 3 centuries?
Yeah, sure. That gives us plenty of time if the world doesn't fall apart to come up with some more engineering solutions to extremely difficult problems. But yeah, you could conceivably start to do some interstellar communication and observation, certainly. Just becomes a question of determination
at that point.
Do you have enough people working to solve these kinds of problems?
Awesome. Really appreciate your time, Alex. We look forward to supporting your mission over there.
Yeah, of course. I hope the explanations were accessible enough.
Right. Okay. Sounds great. Yes.
Okay, well, have a good one. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Peace.